Well, you can't go anywhere these days now without hearing stories of breakdowns in psychiatry, strange stories, cases of people put on pharmaceutical drugs, something happens. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Seth Farber about the spiritual gift of madness. Get ready for this compelling show on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Seth Farber, PhD, psychologist, public speaker, founder of the Network Against Coercive Psychiatry, author of several books, including the one we're talking about tonight, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry, and The Rise of the Mad Pride Movement. Here's Seth on Coast to Coast. Dr. Seth, how are you?
Hi, George.
Good to have you with us. You've hit a button here, I think, with people on all these psychotic drugs. Overprescribed. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about yourself, Seth, and how you got into this.
Well, I started out in 1976. I thought I'd do something to make a decent living, and since my parents were willing to pay for me to go to graduate school and help humanity at the same time. And that turned out to be a trickier negotiation process than I thought. I got my PhD in 84. I became more and more critical of what I now call the mental death system, because I think it does more to harm people than to help people. But I was studying various new... I was very interested in so-called schizophrenics and bipolars and people who were psychotic, and I thought there was something that fascinated me about it, and I didn't accept the... party line, then they have an incurable disease. And I became more radical in the way of thinking, but I think my first actual client who was a bona fide schizophrenic was in a clinic I was working in New Jersey shortly after about 5 years after I got my PhD. And I believed I saved him from a lifetime of being a chronic paranoid schizophrenic. In other words, he was labeled as a schizophrenic. All of the authorities told him he was a schizophrenic, and I can tell you, I could, you know, go into more detail if you want, but just to make it brief, and then I'll tell you more if you want.
Sure.
I had opposition. I lost my job because of my encouraging, we'll call him Jim, to get off the psyche. He was a 25-year-old kid, and I was about 10, 15 years older than him, to get off the psychiatric drugs, because they do far more harm than they do good, particularly the so-called antipsychotics. By the way, whenever I say that, I feel I should immediately say, people who are listening that are on them, don't stop taking them abruptly, because you can go into terrible withdrawal symptoms. But I encouraged him to try to get off it slowly, and he turned me on to the Mental Patients Liberation Movement, which I hadn't heard about at the time. Now, I know sometimes I talk too long, so I'll stop and pause to ask which...
You're going to like this, Seth, because my guest before you has just written a book about how you should only talk in 30-second increments.
Oh, really? I didn't turn on. I was just kind of resting up. Well, that's just coincidental then, or synchronistic.
Well, look, if I think you're going too long, I'll jump in, so don't worry about that.
Yeah. Well, I could tell you, you know, either what happened to Jim or how I met the mental patients, or I could, that was how... Basically, how I first, took that turn in the road from being a normal psychologist to being a supporter of the Mental Patients Liberation Movement, which, you know, now we call Mad Pride Movement. It has had different names. And I also found out, I said I cured this guy, so to speak, of his so-called schizophrenia. I say so-called because I don't really believe that he had schizophrenia, but he definitely was. He had a voice that he was speaking to all the
time.
Sure.
Okay.
I found out 10 years later that I had cured him. I use the word cured in quotation marks, too, because I don't go along with the idea that he had a incurable illness. I think he was just having life problems. And I could tell you how I did that, and I could tell you how I became so excited when I met these people in the mental, what was then called the Mental Patients Liberation Movement.
Well, Seth, let me ask you something about that, first of all. You know, in the old days, you know, the old 1700s, the 1800s, they'd have these mental institutions. You'd see these old movies of people walking around in a zombie state. God knows what they did to these people. How many of them do you think truly had a medical problem, or they were just tossed in there because they were different or something?
Well, just going by today, I think they were tossed. They were probably tossed in there for the same reasons, that they were different. In those days, it was quite frequent, common for a husband to toss his wife in a mental hospital because she wasn't doing the dishes or something. You know, they had they were even more conservative than we are and nowadays, and sort of deviating from, of course, you know, it wasn't until two centuries later that they, you know, when I started school, homosexuality was considered, in graduate school, considered a serious mental illness. So things have changed in that way, though it's not as rosy as people think. So I think then as now, the majority of people were locked up there, were victims of the, in the beginning, it wasn't psychiatrists. Psychiatrists took over the mental hospitals in the second. They fought a battle to take over the mental hospital, the hospitals for the insane. A lot of people were just poor and unemployed, and that was how the birth of the asylum. So I don't think the majority. Of course, as Thomas Dawes, the author of The Myth of Mental Illness, talked about, a lot of people that were considered schizophrenic then had syphilis, because that really did make you crazy.
Right. It was a disease. And when you talk about, you know, schizophrenia and other psychiatric issues, you don't toss in, let's say, the serial killer, the real serial killer who has gone off and killed 10 people or something. That's a different kind of mental illness, isn't it?
100%. It makes it hard for me when I'm trying to, you know, help people who are not violent get out of mental. Someone called me last night. Her son I get these calls. Had been locked up in a loony bin for a month. That this kid was never violent. He had a little fist fight with his roommate or something, but no history of violence and so on. And I said, geez, it's going to be hard for you to get him out right after what happened with the Holmes. And she agreed that was making it harder. And so, no, I found that the overwhelming majority of I've never met any. I mean, I've known a few people who've become violent, but the overwhelming majority of schizophrenics, now they're called bipolars, I don't think there's a big difference. It's just, you know, if you impress the therapist, you're more likely to get a higher diagnosis, but, you know, get put up a little on the totem pole than the schizophrenics. The poor and people of color all end up as, you know, schizophrenics. Nowadays, they'll elevate so these people are, I'm afraid that they get the bad rap because of the people like Holmes and, people like George, what's his name? Charles Manson. We don't really know much about Holmes yet, but there was a big study, George.
Well, and Manson, though, Seth, Manson was a guy who wasn't even at the murders, and they got him because of him being, I guess, strangely whacked out. Let's talk about Holmes for just a moment, if we can. James Holmes, of course, the one charged today with the killing 12 people, injuring 58 others. In, you know, with our form of government and our form of law, he's innocent until proven guilty. But this is going to come down to either he's going to be guilty of the murders, or he'll be found insane. I'm not sure which in this particular case. But let me ask you a question about insanity, Seth. I mean, anybody, whoever it is, who would kill 12 people and injure 58, and you're not, let's say, in war, for example, you're not, you know, trying to defend your country or anything, but anybody who would kill 12 people and injure 58, aren't they insane?
Yeah, right. I know. That's part of the absurdity of the insanity defense. It allows psychiatrists to kind of draw the map in such a way that benefits them. I mean, because they come in and say, "Well, this is our province, and you got to let this guy off." And on the other hand, we have total control over them. But I basically don't believe in the insanity defense, because, as you said, anybody who does that from the way I define it in the book, I in a sense do believe in insane, because it's anyone who has any kind of ounce of common sense or compassion or wisdom wouldn't commit such
That's an act. Right.
So yeah, so I don't. It undermines the basis for punishment, and I've found that I don't want to be too punitive, because.
Did we lose you? Yeah, we sure did. We're going to have to get you back on the air here. You're gone, and we'll get Tom to get you back and find out exactly what happened. I wonder if you were saying something, Seth, that bothered somebody, and we'll have to get you back. This is remarkably strange, folks. Every time I'm into something with a guest and it's kind of twisted, then they disappear. Poof, they take off. So as soon as Tom thinks he's got him, we'll get him back on. And by the way, in our last hour tonight, here's the schedule for tonight anyway. Couple hours with Seth. We're going to take phone calls with him next hour. I've got open lines the following last hour. I've got a lot of things I want to talk with you about and get your views on that as well. But we're talking about his work, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, where he contends that, you know, psychiatry is out of control, that they've got too many drugs, they're prescribing too many drugs, and that they're literally condemning people when they shouldn't. And, you know, that's just apparently the direction he has been going all his life. He is a chief psychologist, and he speaks publicly about this wherever he goes. So, again, we'll try to get him back on for you. If for some reason we don't, we'll start with open lines a little bit earlier here on Coast to Coast for you. Let me ask you, Tom, are we going to get him or not? Didn't tell you? Okay, you got him? All right, let me punch him and bring you back. Seth, you've returned.
Yeah, hi.
That was weird. What happened to you?
What?
You were just gone, huh?
Yeah, just gone. I mean, I was sitting here, but you weren't, so I don't know.
And well, that has happened before, and we'll send it into our engineering staff to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
Yeah, so I don't think the insanity defense is a very useful thing to have. You know, I would make a distinction between, the law already has distinctions, like whether a person plotted it in advance or whether he or she didn't. So, it's a metaphysical, it's a deep philosophical question. When is someone responsible for their acts, and when are they not? And I believe in treating all people as responsible for their acts, and, you know, their mitigating and aggravating circumstances. And, you know, like Peter Bragan, who's an old friend of mine.
Yeah, he was just on the show earlier, too. He is a dear guy. And he hates psychotic drugs. He hates them, antipsychotic drugs.
And what he was going to say about the insanity defense. I can't remember. But you know, for example, the one guy who committed those famous murders in California. Oh, I know. Peter Bragan is the one that there's usually most of these. Frequently, most of these shooters are on drugs, like, as Peter points out, the Prozac and Zoloft, the called SSRIs, which are, by the company's own admission now, correlated with homicidal or suicidal ideation. But we don't have any, we don't know whether this person was on it. Obviously, there were a lot of factors involved in Holmes' case, but we can't evaluate them as of yet.
No, we can't. But, you know, Peter, you know, we just had a story earlier about the study on road rage, and apparently more women now than men are committing road rage. Peter Bragan is convinced, Seth, that it's drugs, that antidepressants and everything else that people are prescribing are psych. And you know what? But your warning is to be taken very strongly, and that is, if there are people out there now that are taking these kinds of drugs, they shouldn't just stop and panic and say, "Oh my God, what should I do?" They should really get to their doctor and start talking. But don't they help some people, Seth?
Well, first of all, I would say that antipsychotic, the drugs that are called antipsychotics, and I would say that they do far, 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 far more harm than they do good. And if I could cite a number of studies that show that, but especially in the long run, and for the reasons that Peter Bragan, you know, could talk about more knowledgeably with his knowledge of medicine, but they disable the brain. So, but it's been my experience dealing with many schizophrenics over the years that the ones that stay on these drugs don't get better, and they go from one kind of crisis to another crisis to another crisis, whereas the ones that get off, which is a smaller number, you know, I say people should get off, but what they're not told is that these drugs are addictive. In fact, they're told the opposite by psychiatrists. They're not. If they're told anything, they're told they're not addictive. So if they stop taking the drugs, they think that their illness is coming back. And in fact, Peter Bragan's collaborator, David Cohen, David wrote the book with Peter on how to get off these drugs, found that in 66 of the studies that were done getting people off the antipsychotic drugs, they said get off them in a day or a week at the most, where someone has been on those drugs for years needs to take a long time because these drugs are like heroin. The mental health system doesn't want to tell people that the drugs are so horrific, and then they make it harder for people to get off the drugs. They're putting more people on the drugs. The antipsychotic, I think, is the biggest, makes the most money of any of the psychiatric drugs, Zyprexa and drugs like that, the atypical antipsychotics, and they're the ones that are rising the most highly in terms of putting children on these drugs. So, on the surface, you might say, well, it helps, because if you look at someone who's in a state of great distress, and you give them a shot of Haldol, which is what happens in a mental hospital, they're not going to act so distressed. They're going to be overwhelmed by the drug. Are they going to feel happy? Are they going to feel tranquil? I mean, these drugs used to be called large tranquilizers. Major tranquilizers. And everyone I've just spoken to who was on them found them not at all a tranquilizing drug. I can talk about some of the horrible symptoms, but they will, if someone's in a state of terror, quiet them down. But, you know, Henry Stack Sullivan, who was one of the greatest psychologists of the 20th century, considered in there with Freud, and I don't like Freud, but I'm just saying, if you take a course in introductory psychology, you'll learn about Freud and Jung and Henry Stack Sullivan. When they used to, and this was in the 40s, when they used to come to Chestnut Lodge, Dr. Sullivan would give them a glass of wine, and that would tranquilize them.
Sure.
And frankly, I think they'd be better off, much better off, giving them a glass of wine as a tranquilizer than antipsychotic.
Seth, in a moment, we're going to bring Paul Levy, and I'm going to have you explain in a second just who Paul is, and we'll chat with him for a little bit with our special guest, Seth Farber, The Spiritual Gift of Madness. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our guest tonight, Seth Farber, we're talking about his work, The Spiritual Gift of Madness. In a moment, Paul Levy will join us. Seth will tell us all about Paul when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about Paul Levy, then we'll have Seth fill in some of the blanks here. In 1981, Paul had a life-changing spiritual awakening in which he began to wake up to the dreamlike nature of reality. During the first year of his spiritual emergence, we shall say, he was hospitalized several times, diagnosed with having a severe psychotic break. He was told that he had a chemical imbalance. He was a manic depressive. And fortunately, he was able to quickly pull himself out from the rubble, from the medical and psychiatric establishment, and in 1993 started to teach about what he was realizing. Seth, I'll let you fill in some of this, and then we'll bring Paul in. Tell me of your experience with Paul. How'd you get a chance to get to know him?
Mostly through interviewing him. I was looking online to find someone who embodied. The theory of my book is that, and it's based on my experience, but with so-called schizophrenics, and is that they are, the process of spiritual awakening that's taking place on this planet has begun, and among that group of people called schizophrenics and bipolars, and you can see it with the ones that managed to get off the psychiatric drugs. I mean, slowly get off the antipsychotics, which suppress the consciousness, and get out of the system. And there's the ones who stay stuck in the system. And Paul, of course, is extraordinary, but he, and in terms of his intelligence and all, he's not. But he also shows that there are others like Paul the schizophrenics and the manic depressives are the people that could save the planet. They could bring the process of spiritual awakening to the rest of mankind. Paul pointed out to me that Carl Jung said that the second coming of Christ is the Christ consciousness that's going to spread throughout the population. Carl Jung called it the Christification or the Christification of the many. I believe that the Christification of the many is taking place among schizophrenics and bipolars, but most of the time it's screwed up by the mental health system. Paul escaped it, and he's like one of the forerunners. Like Jesus was a forerunner, like St. Paul was a forerunner, we could think of others. In our day and age, Paul is one of the forerunners and who will be what I call a kind of new catalyst for the messianic transformation.
Okay, let's bring Paul in here, Paul. Paul, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. It's really funny for me just listening to you guys talk about me. It's really
and here you are. You know, I used to tell people it's better to at least be spoken of when you're physically alive and you can hear it,
right?
Rather than a eulogy of any sorts. Tell me a little bit about what you went through, Paul, and
sure.
How you pulled
and,
yourself.
I think the best way to start is to create a little context. And so I'm an only child, and it wound up that my father was really sick, and I've since coined the term a psychosociopath because it sounds right. And you know, it came out later. He was kind of like a criminal, and I was being really sensitive, like any kid, and being the only child, I was, you know, sort of in the role of being the recipient of his abuse. And it wasn't sexual or physical. It was really emotional abuse, and it created enormous suffering for me. And you know, I'm basically talking right after I graduated from college, so I was in my early 20s, and the suffering was so overwhelming that, and you know, and the thing I should say is that in school, I as far as academics, that really was something that I was always really good at and close to the top of my class. But I quickly figured out that I couldn't figure my way out of my suffering with my mind. And the only thing that was able to really help with my suffering was to just sort of step back and to watch to see what was happening in my mind. And that's what I began doing. And I began doing it for hours a day. And I had a meditation teacher. It's really like a very traditional practice, shamatha. Vipassana is the name of it, where it's just really cultivating this mindfulness moment by moment. So I was doing that very, very intensively. And then at a certain point, I got hit by a bolt of lightning. But it was not from the sky. It just ignited inside of my brain just as I was sitting in meditation. And I didn't have any idea that in mythologies they'll talk about that spiritual awakening, you know, quite whatever can be precipitated or catalyzed by, you know, bolts of lightning, like with, you know, the Vajra master in Tibetan Buddhism, or Zeus with his thunderbolts. So within a day of getting hit by that lightning, I went into a complete altered state where it was like I had stepped out of, you know, my typical sort of conditioned, repressed identity, and felt like it was basically like I felt like I was on the cutting edge of the Big Bang. And I was also recognizing, oh my God, this is like a dream. We're all like having this mass shared dream. And I went into this incredibly ecstatic state. And so a friend who was visiting me at that point, I was living on the West Coast. I graduated college, you know, a couple of years before on the East Coast. He was visiting me, and from his point of view, and I totally understand this, it was like, whoa, you know, really scary. And he brought me to a hospital, and we were in, it was in the Bay Area, and they decided to get an ambulance to bring me to a hospital in the East Bay, to, you know, to some sort of psychiatric hospital.
Out of your own control, right?
Oh yeah. I was at that point, I wasn't in my normal mind. I was just so surrendered to what I was experiencing that, you know, I was just following the dreaming. And I mean, it's so hard to describe with words, the sort of altered, you know, the altered state that I was in the sense that it was like being under a spell and actually snapping out of a spell and really beginning to see the nature of the situation that we're all in.
Well, when you were in this state, if people would talk to you, would you be able to answer them, or were you like out of it?
Yeah, no, I was definitely able to answer and converse, but you know, what was happening was that I was beginning to have like really like to actually see that we were interconnected and interdependent. So it was like I had stepped out of the identity pattern of having an imagination that I existed as a separate self that was separate from other people. So it was like, you know, it was such a total like this shock of having the realization that, oh wow, it's like I'm inside of my psyche, that everybody walking around were embodied reflections or aspects of me, and that we were all moment by moment in a way having this mass shared dream and co-creating what was happening in our world. But, you know, keep in mind that because this just kind of appeared to me with, you know, just in such an overwhelming way, I didn't have the fluency to articulate. Like, I, you know, here it's been 30 some odd years, and, you know, I'm an author and I'm a teacher, and so I've developed a real fluency in being able to articulate the experience. But, you know, as it was happening, I was just really in the experience. And I'm sure from my friend's point of view and from other people's point of view, I was not like the typical, like, ordinary person who had a, you know, was sort of like, you know, would like, if you think about the typical person, we all behave in a certain, in like a domesticated way. Sure. No, I was completely over the top ecstatic of what I was realizing. So,
and you weren't dangerous to anybody?
No. Nobody, I wasn't, none of that. It wasn't like that at all. I wasn't dangerous at all. But my friend, and he was a really good friend, I mean, he was really concerned. So basically, he brought me by ambulance to a hospital, and in that hospital, so they admitted me to my first psychiatric hospital. It was 1981.
Were you upset when they did that?
Not at all. No, because I, at that point, the only thing I could do was just to surrender and to let go. You know, so I was just following whatever was unfolding in front of me.
Huh.
But the thing is, within a minute of being in that hospital, an event happened in my life that changed my life forever. And I've never returned to the ordinary life I was living.
What was that?
Well, okay, thank you. So they bring me in to the psychiatric, you know, hospital, and they, you know, bring me into this room, and it's like where the psychiatric patients are, just like some sort of like, you know, like some sort of like this lounge or something. And I immediately see this woman who, and her eyes, she can't see. She's blind. Her eyes were blind. Her, you know, totally opaque with no radiance. I mean,
nothing.
You know, it was just, it was so obvious. It couldn't have been more obvious. And keep in mind that there were all these other patients there, but I immediately just found myself drawn to her. And I walked up to her And keep in mind that I'm in this incredibly altered state. And all of a sudden, I began saying these words as if I was saying a script. And it was not me as an ego who was saying anything, but it was like I was channeling something. And all the while, I was staring at her eyes, you know, which were these blind person's eyes. And what I was saying was, all you have to do to see is open your eyes and look. And I kept on saying that over and over, kept on getting closer to her.
Saying it or thinking it?
No, saying it out loud. Saying it to her.
Okay.
And I kept on getting closer, and all the while I'm staring at her eyes. The whole thing took under a minute, and right in front of me, she regained her sight.
No.
Yeah, no. This is totally, I have articles on my website about this. This is something that actually happened. And so, but then, as if it was choreographed, they come, you know, the doctor comes in, and they take me into another room right as that happened, and they strap me up on some sort of a bed. And that was where I spent the night. Now, you know, just if you think about that for a minute, so here I'm like, I'm lying on my back on that bed. I'm strapped up.
You can't move.
I can't move. And I'm totally, you know, I mean, I the whole time I'm having this profound spiritual awakening. And then I just had this encounter with this blind woman. And I'm just tripping out. I'm just like, oh, my God, I'm waking up. I'm having a spiritual awakening. And the experience I was having was that anybody I would think about, just in my imagination, I was feeling like I was bringing them along. So I began thinking about all my friends, and then I began thinking about even people I didn't know, and then I began thinking about all sentient beings.
I'd be screaming and yelling, Paul, telling them to let me go.
No, it wasn't. For some reason, I didn't have that reaction. It was not, you know, really like, if I had a choice, it wouldn't have been the way I would have chosen to have spent the night. You know, but then if I can just complete this little anecdote,
sure.
Because it then finishes that very next morning. So then they unstrap me in the morning. They come and unstrap me, and they bring me into this room, and I'm sitting at a table. The only other person in the room is that woman, the ex-blind woman, and she's just staring at me, and she's smiling from ear to ear, but she's not saying anything. And all of a sudden, just, you know, it was so obvious what was going on. My sort of, you could say, heart chakra just blossomed. And, you know, that was the first time that I had ever had that experience, but it was just really obvious. Oh, well, like, you know, that's my heart chakra just blossoming. And then I understood something. And I understood what had happened the night before, that her eyes were, from the physical point of view, were healthy and fine, but inwardly she was not letting herself look. And somehow she was at the point in her process of being ready to heal. And I, in a way, just got sent by, you could say, sort of like...
You facilitated.
Well, I facilitated, but almost like it was like sent by central casting, in a way, just to pick up the role. Like, it was almost like that role was dangling in the field, just, and somebody was, you know, whether it was me or whoever, it didn't make a difference, just for somebody to pick it up and to step into it. And I, you know, for some reason, I was open, and I was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And I said my lines perfectly, and that helped her to heal.
And then you had a validation of that when she made that psychic statement, remember?
Yeah, no, I definitely...
No, when she asked you, said about the phone ring.
Right, so if I can just continue. So then what happened... Right as I had that insight, then she asked me, she goes, aren't you going to answer the phone call, Roy, from Roy, which is my father's name. Now, my father is, you know, like I said, he was a very sick person, and he was the one who I have all of my stuff with. And then within seconds, in the room walks this nurse, and she says to me that, you know, that my father's on the phone, and because my parents evidently had just heard that I'd have this nervous breakdown.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that was the first of many of these initiatory experiences that I began having. And during that, you know, from between 81 and 82, I would say probably four or maybe even more at different times, I was put in hospitals and given these diagnoses that, oh, you're mentally ill, you'll have this illness for the rest of your life. And it was, I mean, I can talk a lot about it. I mean, it was a very, very extreme situation.
And well, Paul, did they pump you with drugs too?
Yeah. Well, that night when I first, you know, got admitted to that hospital, right as the incident with the blind woman happened, and the doctor came in right at that point, she gave me some pills, and I had no idea what they were, but I just assume when I think about it now that they were antipsychotics.
Oh, probably.
Yeah. You know, and yeah, but the thing was, so that hospital, I got out after 3 days because the person in charge of me, he reflected back to me. He was a doctor, not a psychiatrist, but just, you know, a therapist who reflected back to me that if I began, you know, because I actually had so let go, I didn't even care that I was there. But he reflected back to me that if I was able to appear like that I was this normal person, that he would let me go. So I totally stepped back into my normal persona. Mm-hmm. And began talking about my problems with my father and my suffering and my guilt. And, you know, and I just stepped totally into my persona. And he said, oh, well, then, you know, and
you're fine.
He signed the release for me to be released.
Did you want to leave?
The thing was, what he had said to me was that he actually said, if you don't prove to us that you're not insane, we're going to keep you here for a really long time.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that really got in because then I contemplated, well, you know, here it was the spring, and I didn't really want to stay locked up in a mental hospital for a really long time. And he was basically saying, hey, look, if you want to get out, you have to show us that you're not crazy. So I could do that. So I just completely stepped into my normal identity. And then just to complete this little anecdote, we got together. I called up the doctor, and we had the next, 10 days later or something, we got together for like, you know, dinner or lunch or something like that. And he explained to me, he says that the fact that I was able to just fluidly step into myself and into my normal identity, that proved to him that I wasn't, you know, crazy. And then, of course, I told him about the blind woman. But he immediately got uncomfortable and said, oh, patient confidentiality, I can't talk about that.
But he realized she could start seeing again, right?
You know, I have no idea. Now, the thing I should point out that if I were in my ordinary state of mind, I would have gotten her, you know, name and phone number and contact info and all that. But that was the last thing on my mind.
She'd be on the show with you right now and Seth.
Right, for sure. totally. And so the thing is, so that was the first of you know, many, many experiences. But I was also not in a container. I was out in the world. And I was, you know, just, I was continually deepening this spiritual awakening, but because it was so new and I was, you know, in my, I was like 24, 25 years old, I hadn't developed in my own self, you know, the sort of container to integrate. I mean, the only thing I needed was time and a safe place, like a container to just sort of be able to.
All right. Well, let me ask Seth this, Paul. Seth, how many people like Paul are out there?
Oh, I think thousands. I mean, but most of them don't make it across the river as Paul has, so to speak. But thousands that have had these kind of experiences. But Paul can tell you, and that the more he would talk about, he tried on a few occasions, judging, you know, I know from the interview, to open up to the psychiatrist. They would become crazy. If he say I cured this, and I know this too from my own experience, I was the vehicle for curing this woman. They just write down delusional schizophrenia.
Right.
So I believe that there are thousands of people like that, but most of them are destroyed by the mental health system.
Right. And if I could just say one thing, because like,
hold on, Paul, I'm going to keep you for a little bit. We're going to hit this break. We'll come right back with you, Paul Levy, and of course Seth Farber, the author of The Spiritual Gift of Madness. We'll be right back.